everyone, and we're so glad to have y'all back for episode 8 of Chemistry the Podcast. I'm your host, Lucy, and I am beyond excited to have with me Dr. Isaiah Spate. Dr. Spate is currently in postdoc here at UC Irvine, working in the lab of Professor V. Dong. Prior to coming to UCI, Dr. Spate received his bachelor's in chemistry at Norfolk State University, and afterwards he got his PhD at Vanderbilt University. Other than everything chemistry in the lab, he is also heavily involved with the National Organization for Black Chemists and Chemical Engineers, and he currently serves as the Western Regional Director. I am once again so excited and happy to have you here on the podcast. Thank you for joining me. Before we begin and before you introduce yourself, I just have to ask permission. Can I call you Isaiah?
Yeah, that's perfectly fine.
Cool. Would you like to introduce yourself to our wonderful audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit all the nails on the head in terms of like chemistry background. I actually started off doing polymer chemistry. Then I transitioned to doing sugar chemistry with Steve Townsend. Then for my graduate degree, I ended up doing solid state chemistry, so like the mechanochemistry stuff that everyone kind of sees me doing now. And then now with V, I'm doing like peptides and stuff. So it's been a pretty interesting journey, like all the way through and through. But I kind of call myself now a synthetic chemist versus like inorganic versus organic, because it's all just making things.
Yeah.
So, and then in terms of other stuff, yeah, the Novache stuff has just been great. So I think you got everything.
Awesome. I kind of want to start off with talking about, because you did talk about like a chemistry background and how you kind of switched a lot of different fields and backgrounds. Can you talk to me like more about like the thought process? Like, was there a reason why you chose to maybe switch from more polymers for undergrad to more solid state in grad? And like, was that difficult? Like, did you have to learn new techniques? Because I know, since I'm currently applying and like beginning the process of applying to graduate school, I know they focus a lot on research experience and stuff. Was it difficult for, if when you wanted to maybe not totally like change concentrations, but like maybe change focus, like change fields within chemistry, was it hard to like switch? And did you like, was it complicated both like scientifically, like in the science you knew, and also maybe like bureaucratically and like switching?
So it's interesting because each stage kind of warranted its own change on its own.
Okay.
So when I was an undergrad, the first chemistry that I did like in a research space was polymers. And I was working with Professor Olufemi Oyesanya, who ended up leaving Norfolk State to go start his own business, which is great. And my advisor at the time, Dr. Nweke, told me, he was like, hey, I know a guy, he's doing some chemistry. You need research experience. I think you'd be great to work with him. Give it a shot. And at first, I didn't know who he was talking about. And he never told me who it was until push came to shove. And I met him, and, you know, Norfolk State didn't have a lot of, like, expansive research within the chemistry department at the time. I think there were only like 4 or 5 faculty who were doing research. All of the really like upper level equipment was reserved for the material science program. And so when I met him, it was just he and I in the lab just together.
Yeah.
And that was really my first taste of research. And I think it was good for me to have like that really one-on-one, hands-on approach to things. Because Dr. Oyesanya really taught me a lot about the fundamentals of doing chemistry, setting up reactions, doing reactions. But the problem was is that since all of the upper level equipment was with the materials research program, we were doing a lot of our chemistry blind.
Oh no.
So we'd like do a reaction, work it up, isolate the material, take a small part of it, set it aside for an NMR sample, and then just push the rest of it.
Oh.
And so we didn't really know whether what we had was good or not for the next couple of steps.
Mm-hmm.
And then the NMR at the materials research building ended up going down, so he had to drive his samples to Jefferson Lab, which was like 45 minutes away. So we'd collect samples throughout the week.
Mm-hmm.
He'd reserve time on the spectrometer and then go and then run the samples for us on Fridays. So that was kind of like my first experience, and I was really cool with like the polymer stuff. You know, I gave my first research presentation and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And then Dean Don Brunton at Vanderbilt came to Norfolk State to give a talk about their graduate program. And he was like, you know, we do a summer program, yada, yada, yada. And then like he had talked to my scholarship program director, Dr. Alicia McLean. And Dr. McLean was like, get Isaiah to go. And so Dean Brunson, like, he would call me, he would email, he said, where's your application? Get your stuff together, whatever, whatever. And then he put me in touch with Dr. Stephen Townsend, who he lets me call him Steve. Like, anyone who interacts with him on a personal level, they call him Steve. And so Steve, I emailed Steve and I was like, Dr. Townsend, I'm interested in your stuff, yada, yada. And he was like, okay, cool. Call me Steve. Here's what we do. And immediately I was floored, like using sugars in complex fashion to make additives for baby formula, potentially preventing like group B strep and all these other like antimicrobial things. It was amazing. And I was like, sure, I'm all on board. And so these kind of still fit in the same umbrella of organic synthesis, but they're totally different subdivisions. And that was my first real exposure to graduate level research. Mm-hmm. I had never seen a graduate student in like their natural habitat, so to speak. And so working in his lab was really like the spark to say, I can do this and I want to do this. And so came back, finished off undergrad, applied to a bunch of places, ended up settling in on Vanderbilt. And when I got there, I was doing a rotation with Professor Jeff Johnston. And Jeff, you know, had a really great group. His chemistry is really awesome. I even want to plan to use some of it as, like, I'm doing stuff here. And one of his students said, you should rotate with Tim. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, yeah, Tim Hinusa, he does, like, inorganic stuff. And I was like, why would I rotate in an inorganic lab? And this was a word of wisdom that I give to, like, every person who's going into graduate school or looking into doing rotations. Try something different. Because when I went and rotated with Tim, I learned a lot about inorganic chemistry, air-free technique, glove box chemistry, and then the hook was the solid state chemistry. And it's just a whole new way of thinking about things. So that was really the hardest jump, was going from polymers to inorganic solid state chemistry. But this goes into finding a good advisor. Dr. Hinusa was really, really helpful with developing a project for me that used my background in organic chemistry while also tying me into organometallics while implementing solid state reactivity. And that's where we did the Grignard project. And so that was the hardest jump, so to speak, but I had a really good advisor and a really good community to help me make that transition. And then from there, you know, after I finished, I met V and saw all the stuff that they were doing. And it's like, okay, this is the point where I really started to understand that there are really only two classes of chemists. There's mm-hmm. makers and there's measurers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm a maker. So anything that you put in front of me, somehow, some way, I should be able to find a way to make it. Mm-hmm. So in terms of difficulty to transition, it's really more so of a mindset than it is an actual ability or capability.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've never thought of it that way. Like, it's more of a mindset than an ability.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that everything you learn, like, even though it might be in, like, a different area, everything's still applicable. And it might not just be the science. It can be the way of thinking, perhaps, you know, work ethic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really all about just staying motivated, because chemistry in any facet is going to be difficult, whether you are a maker or a measurer. Mm-hmm. You're going to have experiments that don't work. You're going to have products that you make that you purify and then they slowly decompose. Like, things are going to happen.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing is knowing that you are putting your best effort forward. Mm-hmm. And the chemicals and the compounds don't know you personally. Mm-hmm. So when things happen, it's not a you thing, it's a science thing. And we as scientists have to just learn from what happens. Oh, this thing decomposes over 2 hours. How can I prevent that? What techniques do I know or do other people know that will help? And so those are some of the things that you kind of have to keep in mind when things get tough, because they do.
It's science.
Right, exactly. In any science, really, you know, like, even for mathematicians, they hit walls all the time. And it's a totally different wall from, like, me having to bring forward 20 grams of material because my next step drops my yield, like, to 10%. For them, it's a totally different wall, but the whole thing is just making sure that you... And I heard this from Craig Martins here, and he kind of, like... It's been sitting with me for all this week. Mm-hmm. He said to me, don't look in the mirror at yourself. Look out the window at where you want to be. And that's been sitting with me all week. And I'm like, that's crazy powerful, right? Because it's like, if you look in the mirror, all you're going to see is you and where you are and what you think may or may not be right or wrong. But if you look out the window, You see the world that you want to be in. You see the world you want to create. You see the opportunities you want to take. You see the things that you want to do. It's no longer a question of can I? It's a question of when will I?
That's beautiful. I feel like I need to frame that. to be honest, I fall into the hole, and I feel like I'm not the only one. It's like I blame myself when things go wrong, even though it's probably not me. It's just the science didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by adopting that mindset, it's going to be really helpful because science happens.
It does. It does. And that's why you treat yourself to a good dinner when it does happen or when it doesn't. And you move on.
You treat yourself to a good dinner when it doesn't happen to make you feel better. And then when it does happen, you treat yourself to a better dinner for a celebration.
There it is.
I wanted to, you mentioned like in our pre-podcast, we can say like emails and like chats that you really wanted to talk a little bit more about solid state chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find so interesting about solid state chemistry? Since I think, I do chemical biology research mm-hmm. in my undergraduate research experience so far, and I feel like solid state chemistry is something so far removed from what I do, so I'm interested in learning a bit more. And like, what got you interested? What do you find cool about it? And where do you hope to integrate it into like what you will do perhaps now or in the future after you go on after your postdoc to do amazing things?
Yeah, so I really think that like the area of mechanochemistry is just wild because like you said, it's so far removed from the normal. Like when you think about, let's take it all the way back to like bond dissociation energies, right? Mm-hmm. Most of those are calculated in gas phase. Taking the step from gas phase to solution phase is a little bit safer of a step.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go from solution phase to solid state, and it's a much broader jump. So there are a lot of things that we just don't really, really know yet that we have to figure out somehow, some way. And of course, we could look at, you know, breaking crystals and, you know, TGA analysis and all that other kind of jazz. But like, doing chemical transformations in the solid state, I think it's just absolutely invigorating. There are a totally different set of parameters that to a solution-based chemist, you can kind of ignore, right? So in mechanochemistry, there's the idea that your milling materials are not always innocent. In a flask with a Teflon stir bar and a glass, you know, round bottom flask, you typically tend to ignore those. Your glass isn't going to do anything. Your Teflon's fine unless you're working with like, I think it's KC8 that eats Teflon, which is why you always have to have your solvent in first and you use a glass stir bar.
Mm-hmm.
But like, even in that case, you've got glass. You don't have to worry about it. But in the solid state,
you have to worry about all that stuff.
You can either use stainless steel, which could potentially lead to reduction. You can use copper, which people have used for copper mechanocatalysis.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend James Mack, Professor James Mack at Cincinnati, he's actually done a little bit of this work where he's taken copper milling vessels and done copper catalyzed chemistry because the surface liberates copper ions
That's
to do
so
transformations.
Cool.
It's wild, right? Then you think about it like, oh, you don't have a solvent, so how are you stabilizing things? Well, we've gotten around that too. Either you don't need it, or you could do what's called liquid assisted grinding, where you add just a small, small, small amount of solvent, either to stabilize things or to, you know, make sure your things don't paste up too much. You can use grinding aids, which almost act as like a solid state solvent. You know, there's so many different ways to do chemistry in the mechanochemical sense, because not even just ball milling is a thing, right? There's ball milling, there's tribochemistry. Professor Stephen Craig, who's at Duke, has done mechanochemistry with polymers where he makes these mechanophores, where if you apply a certain amount of force, the material will actually change color. And the first time I saw this was at a talk, I think it was at CERMAX. This was in 20, I think it was in 2017. It was either him or one of his students was giving a talk, and they like drip casted a polymer within a polymer, and they both were the same color at the resting state, but when you pulled on the sides of them, the polymer he drip casted inside of the other one turned blue. Because at a certain mechanical force threshold, bonds were breaking to cause the material to have a chromatic shift.
That's so cool.
And it's like, that's technically mechanochemistry because it's defined as a reaction that's induced by mechanical force, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, you have that. there are people who have done twin screw extrusion. You have chemistry where you can do resonant acoustic mixing. So my friend Tomislav Frischik at McGill, he's super into the whole resonant acoustic mixing thing. And he's gotten reactions that are, they'll start as small as like half gram scale all the way up to 25 grams and pushing into the 50 and 100 gram scale, all in a solvent-free environment. So it's just like the excitement is just from the fact that we are in a somewhat vast unknown space.
Yeah.
A lot of solution-based chemistry and a lot of fundamental parameters of solution-based chemistry are already figured out. But in the solid state, there's still a lot to learn. You don't have the Arrhenius equation, which James Mack has actually done work to kind of find an equal point of the Arrhenius equation in the solid state, but it's still not completely and totally flushed out, right? There are still other parameters. How does your solid state crystal structure influence your reactivity? Lattice energies, how easy are you able to break that material up? You know, what types of collisions are you getting? Are they elastic or inelastic? In most cases, they're not. What other parameters can you change, you know? Ionic liquid-assisted grinding, solid-state grinding aids, doing high-temperature ball milling, low-temperature ball milling, reduced-pressure ball milling, all this kind of stuff, right? And it's just wild because, to me, it's a whole new playground.
Yes.
So that's kind of what got me hooked.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in terms of where I see it going for myself, I kind of want to get into the mechanocatalytic space.
Nice.
I've got a couple of ideas that I'm spitballing, but I also want to try to get into some of the more like engineering and design and figuring out new ways to do mechanochemistry. So that way we can continue to expand the field by coming up with new technologies or new apparatuses to do these solid state reactions in.
That's so cool. I've never thought about it that way. Because I feel like the stereotypical energy is like the solution phase. You see, like, you have all like cool snazzy setup with the flasks and the beakers, but then you never really think about like how the solvent is, or like whatever the molecules that's doing it, actually doing the reactions, how they react with the vessel, because most of the times it doesn't matter if you're doing tradition. Wow. I have to like stop for a moment because I never really thought about that ever before.
It makes you think about chemistry from a totally different perspective.
Exactly.
And I think that's what gets a lot of people interested in whatever chemistry they're doing, is this is a unique take for me to think about things.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk to people who do transition metal chemistry, to people on the outside, it's like, oh, D electrons, cool, whatever, whoopee. But like to them, it's like, okay, well, what metal can I choose to do the transformation I want? And you'll see some situations where they're able to do catalysis where they do one transformation with one metal and then they change the metal and keep everything else the same and they get a totally different product. And that's beautiful chemistry, right? Let's take it to the, you know, the whole Nobel discussion.
Yeah.
A lot of science Twitter was kind of like, okay, well, what?
Yeah.
What is asymmetric organocatalysis? But to us as like makers, we see this and it's like, it's a beautiful thing. And it's a, for them, when they developed the field, it had to be this is a unique perspective on looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what keeps people invested, because they find their view, they find their window.
Yeah.
And they look through their window at chemistry and what they can bring to the world of chemistry. Yeah.
And I think it's so cool. I just found it, since you brought up the whole Nobel discussion, I just thought like the funniest thing was trying to explain it to people totally not in the field of science. I haven't had any of my non-science friends ask me about it yet, but I'm planning on using the hand analogy.
Yeah. I had told my brother about it. So he's in school right now for engineering.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, and he was like, you know, I told him, I was like, you know, my advisor's advisor just got a Nobel.
That's so cool.
Like,
first, I'm like,
it's wild,
so,
right?
It's wild.
But I was like, my advisor's advisor got a Nobel. He was like, oh my God, what for? And I was like, asymmetric organocatalysis. He was like, what the hell is that? And so I was like, well, let me explain it to you this way. When you have, let's take it all the way to medicine, right? In medicine, there are specific ways that a molecule must look and sit and be to be active.
Mm-hmm.
And there are only certain ways that you can make that compound in a lab to look and fit and be that way.
Yeah.
And this is really important because in large-scale synthesis, you can't always use a metal. Because in some cases, the metal might get left behind. It might get carried along. You have to figure out ways to get rid of it. And there are a lot better ways to do it now. Mm-hmm. But the easiest way is to use something organic because you can separate it. Yeah. You can separate it. If it's something that's got a protonatable group, you can protonate it and wash it away. There are ways to get around with organics that you can't always do with metal. And that's where the power is, right? And he was like, yo, that sounds kind of wild. And so we had like a whole discussion about it, and I kind of explained it to him a little bit. But like, it's beautiful, right? Because you can see the start to end, right? The start is in the lab developing a reaction that does this asymmetric catalysis. Mm-hmm. And then the end is we could take that process scale, kilos on kilos of material that use an organic catalyst that's easy to remove.
And it's also better for the environment because a lot of times heavy metals, don't get me wrong, heavy metal chemistry and like metal chemistry is cool, but a lot of the times it's probably not the best.
And it's expensive.
So, again, like, I just think it's so cool how this one small thing that went to a layperson might just be like, oh, this is some like niche chemistry thing, like, why is it winning a Nobel? But but if you look at its implications to every other field of chemistry, and as you said, including medicine, it's very well deserved.
Yeah.
Hey, and also, UCI alum, UCI.
Right. Exactly.
I think what I really wanted to talk to you about, like on this podcast, for is your involvement with the National Organization for Black Chemists and Chemical Engineers. Firstly, can you like tell our listeners a bit more about like what exactly do you do for the organization and what's your role as the Western Region Chair is?
Yeah. So I actually just transitioned into this role. Like, this is my first week on the job.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you. But before that, I was the national student representative. And so that role now falls to a good friend of mine, Leo Fontenot. So he's a graduate student at LSU. And so the role of national student representative was really to be a voice of the student population of the organization to the board. So that way when executive actions or actionable items come up, a student voice is there to make sure that they are not left out of the decision making. That it's an equitable opportunity for all members of the organization, because the board is predominantly people who are in professional positions, whether it be in industry, government sector, academia, early or late stage career, is still a professional voice. And sometimes people still remember like, oh, okay, when I was an undergrad, when I was a grad student, here's what I needed or here's what I wanted. Mm-hmm. But having a current voice and a fresh voice is what's important. And so after transitioning from there to current, my current role as Western Regional Director is pretty much to be an oversight to everything that the Novache Western map touches, right? And so when student chapters get started or professional chapters get started, I help them with forming a constitution and bylaws, making sure it's in line with the national organization, making sure they have the resources to start their chapters and maintain their chapters, speaker lists, funds, initiatives through K-12, things of that nature. But also just to make sure that they always have somebody that they could come back to. Because there are always situations where faculty may move, they may change locations, students may graduate, right? And so there may be a shift in power, a change of command within the chapter. But I am here for sure for 2 years, right? And so it's like, if something happens within my chapter and I don't have somebody to help me lead, or I have a question about process that I don't really understand, they can either email their faculty advisor, who may still be there or may have chosen to change locations, or they can email me. And then I can either give them a definitive answer or connect them to another chapter. So it's like it's a conduit between all of the chapters within, you know, the region.
Okay. For our listeners who might not be quite familiar with what Novache does, and what do you want them to know about the organization, and most importantly, like, how has it helped you as a Black chemist, and how do you envision it, like, as like chair, to help like Black students or chemists anywhere in the career, from undergrad, maybe even pre-undergrad, to grad school, professional.
So Novache itself, the way that I feel about it is it's a space for Black chemists to truly be Black chemists, where they don't have to wear the face, do the song and the dance. They could be themselves. They can showcase their chemistry. They can really get integrated into a community that feels like it was made for them because it was made by them.
Yeah.
And so for me personally, it was a really huge step that carried me through graduate school, because Vanderbilt has a decent Black graduate student population, but in terms of chemistry alone, the numbers are still relatively small. Mm-hmm. And we're all kind of spread out across the department, so it's not always that I see somebody else. Like, I got lucky, and working with Tim, I was next door to Steve, and so I would see Steve all the time, and we'd have conversations and etc. But in terms of other graduate students, the only other person that I had on my floor was my friend Devin Taylor, who ended up leaving early. Mm-hmm. And so when he left, it was kind of just me.
Oh.
And, you know, that's when Professor Renee Robinson, who's currently the president of the organization now, when she came to Vanderbilt, she immediately came to me and was like, we need to involve Novache in the department. And at the time, I really had no idea what the organization was. And she was like, come to a conference and find out. And that's where I met literally everybody who's in like my immediate circle now.
Uh-huh.
My friend, Dr. Victoria Parker, who's now at Genentech, she looped me in originally, but I kind of like didn't take her advice. She was like, get involved in Novache. And I was like, yeah, whatever. But when I went to that conference with Dr. Robinson, she showed up. And then she introduced me to literally everybody. And then from there, I had my first real sense of network and community, mm-hmm. where I didn't have to try too hard.
Yeah.
I didn't have to spend 20 minutes trying to craft an email, whatever. And so I really think that Novache creates a safe space for Black chemists to really just be.
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest thing I want people to take away from it, is that Novache is helping empower, encourage, and promote Black chemists from all facets. Whether it be a student who's just coming into undergrad, or somebody who's just coming out of graduate school, or somebody who's late career that's trying to make a change, or that's perfectly content in their career but wants to reach out and help. Novache is there at every stage of the game. And that's what really makes it beautiful to me. You know, everybody's got somebody that they can touch base with. And it just feels like a big, big family.
Yeah.
And when we come together for the conferences, it's almost like a homecoming.
Yeah.
You know, everybody comes back. You see people who you may not have seen in a while. You touch base. You have fun. You know, it's just really a good opportunity for people to connect.
Yeah.
So that's my biggest, for people to take away from this, is that Novache is there to help Black chemists be the best chemist in any room that they can be in, by having that support system and network.
And I think having that support system is so important, especially people who relate to you, people who understand your struggles, because chemistry is a field dominated by whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a similar discussion with our previous guest. We talked and we discussed how it's kind of hard if you're a minority and you're surrounded by people who don't exactly look like you, who don't exactly have the same experiences either growing up or throughout your career, that it's important that there's always a feeling of alienation or a lack of understanding, because it's impossible for someone who hasn't experienced the true experience to 100% truly empathize with you. And I'm just so grateful that there are resources like Novache to help people to find a community, because it gives a community for you to grow academically, career-wise, whatever.
Yeah, it's so important to have community. And I stress that to people, regardless of whatever career phase that they're in, have someone that you can connect with and that you can talk to. And it's even better when they're not in your field,
mm-hmm.
because you're not talking about work all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like my best friends from graduate school, Kai Bracey, Logan Northcutt, Jamal Bryant, Ron Benning, those are like my guys.
Mm-hmm.
And even my friend Greg. Greg and I met playing basketball. Greg doesn't do any type of science. He's actually like in business and management. He's also did a little bit in like architecture.
Mm-hmm.
we met playing basketball. He invited me to go hang out at his church, and we were best friends ever since, right? And so, like, all of those guys, like, Kai, Logan, and Jamal are all in biology. Mm-hmm. Ron is my only, like, male best friend that's in chemistry from the Nashville area. And then Greg, who's not in science at all, they were my community. Mm-hmm. When I needed things, I went to them.
Yeah.
I had a rough day at work. I'm with them. Mm-hmm. Weekend plans. We're hanging out.
Yeah.
We used to play basketball together 3 days a week.
Dang.
From whenever to whenever. Oh. We would show up at 4:30 because that's when most of the people from the medical center would get off work and come and play with us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so cool.
And we would play until our legs fell off.
Oh,
like,
no.
There were days where we'd get there at 4:30 and we wouldn't leave until 9:30 because we were just going.
Yeah.
And it was a space where I didn't have to be a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to talk about chemistry.
Yeah.
I didn't have to talk about how my reactions were or were not working.
Yeah.
Or how I had to make edits to this manuscript.
Yeah.
Or how this exam is coming up. And we would dabble in those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Here and there, but we didn't have to. We talked about sports. We talked about movies. We talked about music. We talked about love, life, troubles, and all of those types of things. But it was a space where I got to get away from it. And that's why I tell people, have a good, good friend outside of your normal.
Yeah.
Have a friend who doesn't do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes it so difficult when you want to step away from it when somebody else is in it. Because if they're struggling with things, it's going to be in the same arena.
Yeah.
And it just brings you right back to
back
your own thing.
And then it's kind of the sense of you want like a social mental getaway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important because sometimes I feel like the best way to figure something out is to get away with it.
Right.
But as you mentioned, if all of your friends are in the same field, and it's natural for us humans, we want our friends to empathize with our
mm-hmm.
struggles, and they should. But if all of your friends in the same field, all your struggles are going to be work. And then even if you don't want to talk about work, you end up talking about
right.
work.
But I mean, there's even like just the simple sidestep of not doing the exact same type of chemistry. And so, like, one of my best friends, who I actually have never met in person because of pandemic stuff.
Oh, no.
But we're tight, like, I don't know what. Dr. Devin Swiner, she and I are, like, the best of friends. And we're both chemists, but she's an analytical chemist.
Oh, yeah.
So there's the whole, like, right. So, yeah. So there's the whole, like, makers versus measures thing.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I'm gonna shameless plug. @Devin_11. She's famous, but I'm gonna help her get more famous.
Yes, make Dr. Devin more famous.
Exactly. Hashtag Dr. Dev to 8K. We're trying to push it. We're trying to get her to 10 by the end of the year. So let's do this.
I will drop the @ in the episode description.
Let's do it. But yeah, so Devin's been like a super big support for me because it's like, even though we still do chemistry, analytical versus, you know, synthetic, we still share issues, and that's where, you know, having somebody to empathize, being another Black chemist, and then her also being a Black woman and being a part of the LGBTQI community, like, she has her own experiences that I can't always relate to, but I'm still empathetic to.
Yeah.
And we talk about those things, but we also talk about things that get us totally away from it. She's a Marvel fan. We talk about Marvel movies all the time.
Marvel.
Right. And so, like, just having a friend kind of like between her and Ron, those are my chemistry people. They really bring me some kind of consolation and solace within the field, but I still have those friends that are a little bit further removed
mm-hmm.
that can still relate because Logan, Kai, and Jamal are still in grad school,
mm-hmm.
so we still have the grad school problems, but lab things are totally different.
Yeah.
We talk about different issues, and it's good to just have that community.
Exactly.
And for those who don't have that, that's why organizations like NovaShay mm-hmm. are so important. NovaShay, SACNIS, NSBE, etc. Like, all of those institutions really help build that network of people who relate to you from personal experience.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at it, and I'm like, as you're describing all of your friends and your non-chemistry friends, I'm like making a list of like my non-chemistry friends, and I totally feel the same way. I have one of my best friends, she's a sociology major,
mm-hmm.
and other people are really close to them, like both my roommates are both in film, and
mm-hmm.
it's just so refreshing to like sit there and like not talk about
chemistry
for a little bit, and but at the same time, we all come from a marginalized identity, so we all share, as you said, share this, that, those, and that connection too.
Mm-hmm.
I have to comment on your shirt, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a huge, as some people would call it, spider fan, but I'll take it a little bit further and I'll call myself a spider stan.
I love it. Spider stan.
Yeah.
Put that on a t-shirt.
We should put that on a t-shirt.
Spider stan.
But yeah, I've been a Spider-Man fan since like the dawn of my time. Like it's always been a thing. My mom has pictures from, I think when I was like 5 or 6, of me like as Spider-Man for Halloween, you know, like
that's so cute.
I had t-shirts, I had socks,
that's
I
so
had
cute.
The whole setup with the mask and everything. I remember they bought me like the web shooters with the super huge cans on the arm, so that and I was the most annoying thing. My mom took them and hit them because she was so sick and tired of me. So I've been like a spider junkie for like ever, all the video games, and me and my dad, we actually connected a lot through like the comics.
Oh yes.
Because my dad is a super huge like comic book, like sci-fi movie person.
Yeah.
And so he actually introduced me to collecting comics. So like I have a small collection. I don't have as many as I want.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to try to get back into it whenever I get like some actual me time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
outside of all the things that I do.
So you do so much.
Right. But like when I have some time and a little bit of extra finance, you know, I'm definitely hopping back into the comic book space.
Yes.
Because it's so cool. Like my dad, he got me this one comic, and it was one of the Amazing Spider-Man comic series.
Yeah.
And this was right after, or I want to say maybe a couple of months after 9/11 hit. And at the end of the comic was an actual, like, I think it was like 10 or 12 pages of them rescuing and recovering people, all the superheroes that live in New York, alongside EMTs and firefighters and all that
so
kind of
cool.
stuff, saving people from the wreckage of 9/11.
Wow.
And that was really kind of what hooked me on comics, was the fact that you could see so much emotion and connection and storyboarding. And there was literally no words
mm-hmm.
on like most of these slides. Like I think the only words that were on the slide, I mean on the comic pages, were on the very first slide where Spider-Man's in his apartment and it shows like him listening to radio comms
mm-hmm.
from like police reports. And then the next panel is literally him sitting on the top of a rooftop, and all you see is shit. And it's like the smoke, the fire, all that kind of stuff. And then like every page after that, there's no words. It's just images of like heroes and villains alike saving lives. Magneto lifting up girders while Wolverine cuts them off to like get people out of trouble. The Thing lifting up buildings and like all of these, Mr. Fantastic literally wrapping people up and bringing them out of the building. Everybody was there. Captain America using his shield to support
mm-hmm.
rubble to get people out. And like that was, for me, that was like a major, because I'm turning the page.
Yeah.
And this is me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at the thing and I'm like almost in tears.
Because
I'm like, this is moving.
Yeah.
And I think that people, like they see comics and they're like, oh, okay, you know, they're cool, whatever, it's just comics. But like, it's such a, there's such an emotional component to all of it, and it's a beautiful thing. And like seeing that now translate into like the movies,
yes,
you know, the MCU has been like my biggest thing.
It's so good.
It's crazy like how ingrained into it I've gotten. I'm a big gamer, and so like when Insomniac Games came out with their version of Spider-Man, I think it was 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I can't remember. I have collectively spent maybe $700 to $750 on that individual independent project.
Oh, gosh.
I bought the limited edition PlayStation 4 Pro.
Uh-huh.
I bought the collector's edition of the game.
Love
I have
it.
3 other copies of the game, the game of the year, the digital, etc.
Uh-huh.
Like, I spent so much money on that game just because as a Spider-Man
yeah.
fan, I was like, there's no way I can't.
It was worth it.
It was so worth
so
it.
So worth it.
If I had to do it again, I'd probably buy 2 collector's editions so I could have one that I never opened.
Aw. Yeah. I totally agree. I had a conversation with a friend once because we are both superhero fans. And then a lot of my like non... So you know how you have like the Marvel fans
mm-hmm.
and you have the people that just watch it because it's hyped up.
Yeah.
And rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
It's hyped up for all the right reasons. But I remember when we watched I got a big group of friends and friends of friends together and we watched Endgame.
Oh.
Nobody really understood why I was so, like, it was so, I was so emotional at the end. I was like, it's just a movie. It's,
no.
No, it's not just a movie.
No, it's not.
It's not just a movie.
I went and saw Infinity War by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, friends didn't really understand, like, why I was so hell-bent on this movie. And so I went, I saw it, and then when Tom Holland, aka Peter, like, got snapped away. Because you know he, like, ad-libbed that entire scene.
I know.
Yeah.
I only recently found out that he ad-libbed.
So that scene, like, crushed me. And then you see, like, Thanos sitting at the farm, smiling on a grateful universe, whatever, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then movie ends, post-credit scene, whatever, whatever. And then I leave the theater, and it's raining. So it was insult to injury because I'm already sad. And then I walk out the theater and it's raining. And I'm like, yo, like, what the?
What's going on?
What is happening here? And then, of course, they're like, yeah, you got to wait a year. And I'm like, man. So I saw so many jokes of, like, people either on Twitter or on whatever that were like, when my kids get old enough to understand these movies, I'm going to show them Infinity War. And then I'm going to make them wait a year to watch Endgame so they can feel what I felt.
I remember when I walked out of Infinity War, I was just, like, numb to the world. And
yes.
I got really angry because I'm like, I have to wait a year to find out what happened.
But I think that one, I think Infinity War, for me personally, was better than Endgame.
Yes,
just because of, like, the shock factor, because we never see heroes lose. And if they lose in the middle of the movie, so there's, like, at least another hour for them to fix it. And whatever fixing it looks like will vary, but, like, there's always time for them to fix it. In this case, there was no fixing
it. It was by definition apocalyptic.
Right.
And you're not used to seeing that, but...
You're not.
And, yeah.
But I saw something that made me rationalize why they, like, in terms of creative vision, allowed Thanos to win.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is titled Avengers Infinity War. But it is a Thanos-driven movie. He is the actual main character of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that has a major character arc. He goes on this crusade and does these things and succeeds at the end. Endgame is the actual Avengers story arc plot line finisher, right? And that's what made it make so much sense to me. I was like, okay, I can see this now. This makes so much sense. It's a Thanos movie who I don't like the way he did it. But his rationale is not wrong, so I can't be mad at him.
Yeah.
And I hate that Marvel's been doing that lately, because ever since Ultron,
all the villains are like,
I can see your point. I don't like how you're doing it, but you're not wrong.
Ever since all the villains after Ultron, you're like, I feel like it makes the villain less of a villain and more of perhaps an anti-hero.
Yes.
Because I feel like the classic comic book villains, like, oh, they're just objectively a morally a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
But then so many villains now, and I think the villains just keep getting better.
They do.
Because it's like you are able to empathize with them, you're able to understand where they're coming from,
mm-hmm.
for their means of achieving it. Or something along the way.
A little
questionable. I'm taking that you're excited for Spider-Man in December.
Oh my god. My body is ready. I have never been more excited for a movie in my life.
Yeah.
But this is going to be the one.
It's going to be... I'm like scared and excited too.
Mentally and emotionally, I cannot fathom what I will feel.
Do you think they're going to bring the old Spider-Man back?
Okay, so this is a jaded conversation. There's only one old Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
and that is Tobey Maguire. There is no other one. Andrew Garfield doesn't exist. Those movies, I personally hate those movies. Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2 do not exist in my world. And there are people who are like, they're not that bad. Andrew was good. No, he was not. That script was not written for him. He was not Peter. He was not Spider-Man. And, like, I've watched movie critic reviews on it to, like, further emphasize my hatred of these.
Yeah.
And they're all so bad. Like, I admit, Sam Raimi's Amazing Spider-Man 3 was overly convoluted. Mm-hmm. I literally just watched that movie last night out of impulse. But, like, it's a little convoluted, right? Yeah. And then the whole, like, Eddie Brock thing where he's like, yeah, you know, I'm a D-bag, but, like, I have a reason. No, you don't. No, but yeah. Whatever. Like, and then just immediately powers up. Him and the symbiote bind, and they're like this perfect, you know, harmony, whatever. Yeah. Like, I get it, but I don't always agree with it. And then the only person in, like, the third Spider-Man movie that had, like, a true character arc was Flint Marko, mm-hmm. who was Sandman. He had, like, a true character arc all the way through.
Perfect.
Harry had a minor character arc. Peter didn't really learn anything.
Yeah, Peter was just kind of funny.
Like, he was a D-bag for, like, 80% of the movie, and at the end, he's like, but I love you, Mary Jane. Whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, the Amazing Spider-Man movies with Andrew Garfield are start-to-finish garbage. Absolute trash. I hate them so much.
Valid.
Yeah. And I think the reason I hate them so much is because my friends forced me to watch them. Because I watched the first one. I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it on, like, I think I saw it on, like, on some rental service or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this sucked. The suit was trash. The story was trash. All of it was trash.
Yeah.
And then my friends were like, we're going to go see the second one. I'm like, I'm not going to see it. They were like, come on, let's go. Yeah. We're all going to go. We're having fun. Whatever. Right. And I'm going because my friends are going. And I'm sitting in the theater the whole time, pissed. And they're looking at me like, it was all right. I'm like, no, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, no.
So, but this one.
Yeah.
This is the one. And I know that it's the one because even in the last one, in Far From Home, mm-hmm. I have waited years to see certain Spider-Man villains hit the screen. I've always wanted to see how people would do Kraven the Hunter. I've always wanted to see how Madame Web would make her appearance. I've always wanted to see some other people too. And the way they did Mysterio, because Mysterio was always the one that was questionable about.
Yeah.
Because you see him in the, like, in the video games, you see him in the comics, and it's like, here's what he should be able to do. And even in the video games, they didn't always get it right. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Spider-Man 2 for PlayStation 2 did it right. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't done the way that we would expect it to be done now. Yeah. Because, of course, graphics limitations and whatever. Mm-hmm. But, like, seeing how they did him in Far From Home was what I wanted. I saw that movie in theaters.
It was so good.
And every time Mysterio started doing things, messing with the environment, you felt fully immersed that the environment you were in was what you were supposed to believe.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's no better way to do this. If anyone else tries to do Mysterio after this, they're gonna do it wrong. Because this was the way to do it. So yeah, so
I'm so excited.
No Way Home is going to be the best Spider-Man. I'm calling it now, and this is a very hard claim to make, but Spider-Man No Way Home is going to be the best Spider-Man movie ever made. Right now, my number one Spider-Man movie is amazing. Is Spider-Man 2. Mm-hmm. You know, with Doc Ock and all of that. No. But the fact that they're bringing Alfred Molina into this just immediately makes it a contender.
When I watched the trailer and then you saw the big Doc Ock arm come up in the hello piano, I was...
Chills. Yes. I hit chills. I'm so ready.
I feel like I'm emotionally ready, but, like, I'm also not ready at the same time because I don't know what they're gonna do.
You cannot prepare for this.
You can't prepare. And the whole Doctor Strange and the whole...
He's about to have a world of problems on him because after he figures this out, then he's got the Multiverse of Madness.
Multiverse of Madness, and then...
And him and Wanda are gonna duke it out something serious, and I am afraid.
I'm so scared.
Because I feel like Wanda's gonna beat him because she's, like...
She's the most powerful being in that universe, right? Or
for now, because until Kang the Conqueror shows up, then we got a whole new power scaling, and it's gonna get ridiculous. Like, I cannot wait.
I cannot wait.
The fact that they pretty much said, and I guess these are spoiler alerts for people who haven't watched Loki, but whatever. The fact that they pretty much nullified the Infinity Stones, mm-hmm. you got a whole new power gamut.
Yeah,
like. Kang the Conqueror is about to start ripping up total universes just because.
I am so excited for the rest of Phase 4. I'm just... to all of our chemistry listeners, I apologize, but when you get two Marvel fans together, this is inevitably what happens. we are almost out of time, unfortunately, but my last more serious question is, how do you envision yourself as... as after, perhaps after you complete your postdoc, and to the future, how do you vision yourself as a chemist and how you want to contribute back to the community?
Yeah, so my biggest thing has always been mentorship. I have been blessed with amazing mentors throughout my entire academic career. And so I always want to be a mentor and a positive force for the next generation of scientists. Mm-hmm. So I'll take it from, I guess, three different perspectives. As a chemist, I want to stay in the solid state synthesis realm, okay, develop some new methods for mechanochemistry. As an educator, I really want to start to push the boundary in the marriage of tech and learning. So I really want to start bringing AR into the learning space. You know, augmented reality learning tools are going to be there, and yes, they're going to be amazing. If we as chemists put our foot in the door and say, here's how you make these things great. And then the last thing, of course, is always just going to be as a mentor and as a guide. Because I feel like with the proper mentorship, growth, and nourishment, any student could become the next Dave McMillan.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think those are my three things that I want to build onward as me as a chemist to the community forward.
That's great. Love to see it. And finally, I feel like I have to conclude with our classic chemist tea podcast question, which is, what is your favorite type of tea?
Oh, ooh. So this is a tough one because I've been like dabbling in a lot of different teas,
yes,
lately. So I'd say in the morning, it'd be like a nice Earl Grey.
Oh, so good.
But in the afternoon, it could either be a vanilla chai or maybe even a chamomile if it's late afternoon.
That's great. I love chamomile. And I also love the whole dabbling in tea things. I love buying like those tea samplers.
Yeah.
Where they give you like lots of different flavors and then you try them all. Okay, I think we are almost out of time. So thank you so much again,
no,
Isaiah,
thank you. This was great. I really
appreciate
it. Coming
to this podcast. I really appreciate you having you here. And for me popping into your DMs on Twitter and being like, I need another guest.
It's all good. It's all
it's
good.
So great. We're both at UCI doing amazing work, both in the lab in chemistry and also with Nebuche. So
yeah.
I hope that our listeners are inspired by this podcast. And with all of our Marvel tangent towards the end, I hope you enjoy that too. thank you guys so much for supporting Chemistry Podcast. You will find links to Nebuche and also Dr. Spate's Twitter in the episode description below. Also in the episode description below, you'll find a link to this podcast's Ko-fi donation page. We are an unsponsored podcast, so any contribution will be highly appreciated. Thank you again so much for listening, and we hope you have an amazing rest of your day. Bye-bye.